Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, your host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Andrea Lawrence Simpson about her new book, Just Like Family, How Companion Animals Join the Household. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me, Christina.
I'm excited to talk about your book and our shared love of animals in the family. But before we dive into that, I wonder if you will please tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am a research assistant professor of sociology at the Southern Methodist University in Dallas. I have a multi-species family myself. In fact, I grew up in a multi-species family. It was a little bit different than the multi-species family that I have now, but I have two boys, a tween and a teen, and they are both a handful. And my husband and I live north of Dallas, kind of working with them and our three dogs. We have three German short-haired pointers. Two of them are seniors, and one of them is almost 2 years old now. So he is a teen himself and is interesting to watch interact with the family. So, and I mentioned that I grew up in a multi-species family, which is somewhat different. And of course, if you've read the book, knowing that I grew up in the 70s would mean that my family at that time was different. But my parents bred Scottish Terriers and Chinese Shar Pei throughout my childhood. So I had a lot of exposure to just dogs in general, puppies, pregnancies, and caretaking of dogs, and so on and so forth. So certainly, as with anybody's research, my past has informed my present and informs my work. So that's me.
And one of the things I love to ask my guests is if they'll share a bit about their own academic journey with us, how you chose your field of study, and if you knew early on or if something at college pointed you towards it.
Oh, my goodness. I had kind of a bumpy academic history. I finished my undergraduate at University of Houston, and my major was psychology with a minor in sociology. And at the time... This is kind of embarrassing, but I'm happy to share this. At the time, as I was finishing up, my husband and I got married, and I decided after a long history in theater, so this is, sounds like we're kind of getting off track, but after a long history in theater and graduating with my undergraduate in psychology, we decided that we would move to Los Angeles and I would pursue a career in acting. Needless to say, you can see that was not a successful choice. but I kind of had this break in my academic career because I kind of veered off of that road and went and experienced life as a professional actress and did that for a couple of years and then wound up realizing that probably was not the route for me and ultimately decided to go back to grad school. I chose to go into sociology instead of psychology because sociology was my minor, not my major. I chose to go into sociology because I had really enjoyed those classes as an undergraduate. I had enjoyed especially kind of the interfacing between psychology and sociology, which was social psychology. And I liked that I could still kind of think about individual micro level, group level interactions that you would do in a psychological context while kind of connecting more macro level social structures and features to that conversation. And do that still with this kind of foundation of psychology, as long as I stayed on the micro end of sociology. And so ultimately I decided to go into sociology. I started my graduate program with the intention of finishing my doctorate at the University of California, Riverside, and really enjoyed that. Met some big players in identity theory, especially in sociological social psychology. That was Peter Burke and Jan Stets, and thought that I'd found my home. And then family happens. And so my husband's job decided that they wanted to promote him, and we had a decision to make. And female academics, I think not just female academics, but female professionals in general are very familiar with that decision. So we had a decision to make if we would stay in Los Angeles so I could finish out my doctorate, or, you know, move on. We had to move to New Mexico for that. So move on to New Mexico and pursue his career. And we chose to pursue his career. And actually not New Mexico. I'm sorry. We moved several times for his job. That time we moved to Dallas for his career. And got to Dallas. So I told you this is like a big kind of roller coaster journey to where I finally am now. Got to Dallas and we were here for about a year and decided to start having kids. So we had our first son in 2006. And then when he was three, we decided to have our second, which is kind of a funny story in and of itself. Just that when we were originally married, I didn't want children at all, and he wanted three. And we just kind of decided together that we would cross that road if we ever came to it. But we stayed that way for 12 years. He wanted three. I didn't really want any. And then eventually I decided, okay, one. So the one was 2006. And then I had the one and still out of grad school, right? But teaching, I was lecturing. So I was adjuncting at the time. Had my first son 3 years, well, I guess 2 years passed. And I looked at my husband and said, "Ooh, I want to do this again." So he said, "Yes, let's do it." So we had our second son in 2009. And again, continuing to adjunct, not like completely letting go of it, but not back in school at all, had the second son. And then, a couple of years passed and I kind of played with the idea of a third child. And my husband was like, "Are you crazy?" No. So we flip-flopped, right? I'm thinking about a third child and he's like, no. And, you know, I thought about it and decided I really wanted to go back. I was tired of adjuncting, tired of, and if you've ever kind of had your master's and adjuncted and stepped out of grad school for a while, but still had the dream of becoming a professor, you might be empathetic to this. I was tired of feeling like I was an imposter, which we still deal with, even with our doctorates, right? We still deal with imposter syndrome, but you really, 100%. Yeah, but you really deal with it if you don't have that handy little doctor piece, that title in front of your name. And so I went back to school for my doctorate. Initially I had thought about going to UT Austin, but UT Austin was 3 hours away. And I had a kiddo at that point that was my youngest one was two. And I didn't see the utility in spending 3 hours of commuting on a train 3 days a week to go to class and then come back to my kid. I just thought that that was going to be really, really difficult on my family and on me emotionally. Grad school is emotionally draining as it is. I didn't need to be throwing in 3 hours both ways, possibly staying overnight, you know, with a two-year-old at home. And against better advice, at least they would have said so. My mentors at the time said, "You're a fool if you don't go to UT Austin." And I said, "Well, I guess I'm a fool. I'm going to go to Texas Women's University." UT Austin has a much better reputation in sociology than Texas Women's. They're ranked. Texas Women's is not ranked. And obviously UT Austin is highly ranked. I think they're probably in the top 20 universities for sociology programs. But I decided to just salvage my mental health beforehand and stay local. So finished my doctorate and did that in about 3.5 years, finished out in December of 2016, and then graduated and went on the job market. And so ultimately wound up with a position at Southern Methodist University, which is where I still am today. I started out as a visiting lecturer, then became a renewable lecturer, a full-time renewable lecturer. And then just this year, I've become a research assistant professor. That is my journey.
I love that journey. And I love that you told us. I think people have much more twisty journeys than most of us realize. And I think the accepted thing is often to say, I graduated from this school, and this school, and now I have this job. Yeah. And we kind of, as listeners or as people in the conversation with you, think, oh, wow, you know, she just had this very linear path. You know, it was just goal, goal, goal. Mm. But you've had a lot of life goals, and balancing them and prioritizing them involved a zigzag rather than a linear progression. And one of the questions I have, though, for listeners, because I think a lot particularly of female students will relate to this, is wondering what happens when you leave one program, you have a gap, and you realize you want to keep going. So at the point that you left Riverside, had you gone as far as the master's? Were you into doctoral work? At what point were you making this decision to leave, and how did you leave it with them?
Oh, that was interesting. And probably I try hard not to look back on that decision with regret. And when I do, I remind myself of my boys, and I lose all regret. But the decision at the time, or when I left the program at the time, I had finished my master's. I had gotten into the coursework for my doctorate or course requirements. And I had, this is so hard to talk about. I had one quarter of course requirements left before I would have done my comps. So one quarter and then comps. And my advisors at the time were just like wide-eyed, astonished that I would choose to just wholesale leave. And they were like, just stay in residence for one more quarter and you can go wherever you want. You can do your comps wherever you want. You can definitely do your dissertation work wherever you want. You got to do your classes in residence and you've only got a quarter left. And I just was like, nope, nope, nope. I'm going to move with my husband. I'm dedicated to, and I still am. I don't want this at all to sound like I am blaming my husband or his job in any way, because I'm not. At the time, I remember distinctly one of my female advisors looking at me and saying, is your husband making you do this? Because she was just astonished, right? You've got one quarter left, just astonished. And looking at her and saying, well, of course not. No. In fact, he's kind of looked at me and said, I'm crazy and for doing this, that why would I not just stay in residence for one quarter? But I had it in my mind. I was younger. See, how old would I have been? Oh, do I want to reveal that? I don't know if I want to reveal that. I was younger. Let's just say I was younger and I just chose to go on. And I actually did hold on to, one of my professors had a huge grant working in education, and he really tried so hard to keep me on by saying, you know, I'm going to keep you on this grant as a grad student and you can work long distance, which was not something he typically would have done. You can work long distance. I'll just need you to fly in maybe once a semester or maybe once a quarter or not semester, once a quarter for meetings. And the rest of the time you can work long distance. And I even let that go. So it is a looking back on it and looking at my reasoning now, you know, hindsight is 20/20. It's something that I regret. I was very, very close. But it is also one of the reasons that I was able to finish out my doctorate. When I finally went back, I was able to finish it out in 3.5 years. So.
And had you maintained any relationships with the mentors? You said you talked to your mentors about choosing a new school, and then you didn't choose the one that they said. Were these the same mentors you had at Riverside? Had you continued to stay in touch? Did you need to renew that conversation? How did that come about?
I stayed in touch with one, and that was the professor that was working in sociology of education. I stayed in touch with him and kind of really worked for a year or two leading up to finally going back with him in terms of just, you know, smart steps, where I should go. Maybe, you know, one of the conversations he and I had was maybe you could, if you're going to commute to Austin, Why don't you just get on a flight? Because it would be a similar amount of time and fly back here. Why don't you come out here and finish it up? So we had that conversation. But he was the one that I stayed in touch with. And then the other person that I'm referring to as a mentor had been with me kind of through my adjunct journey to, so I'm going to back up, two sociology professors here in Dallas, one at UT Dallas, where I had adjuncted, and then one at UT Arlington, where I was presently adjuncting. Both of them were extremely supportive in getting me back into a doctoral program. And so really, they were the two really pushing me to go to UT Austin. But I just couldn't see balancing that, right? That work-family balance. I couldn't, even going back out to UCR, I couldn't see balancing that with two young kids. I am, each family does things in their own way. And I find myself very dedicated to my career and to my profession, but very dedicated to my children as well. And so I'm constantly walking a fairly stressful tightrope between the two of them. And that was probably one of my first experiences dealing with that tightrope, was feeling like I want to be a super mom to these kids, but I also want to be a super academic. So how am I going to make that happen? And that was what I did. I'm going to make it happen by staying locally, going to TWU, even with my advisors all kind of saying, no, don't do it. It will be the death to your career. Yeah. So I don't know if it was the death to my career, but you know, it periodically puts up obstacles because I'm not coming from a highly ranked department. So yes.
I appreciate you sharing that story. And if it helps when you look back in hindsight, it's incredibly, I don't want to say common, but I hear those similar type story from many women. They reach a crossroad where their academic journey is in one place, and either their partner is in a different place, or there's a family concern of another family member that they have responsibilities towards. Or they've reached information based on private conversations with their doctors that family planning is something they need to handle imminently.
Absolutely.
And so there can be a number, and those are just three examples out of a buffet of reasons. There can be health reasons, all kinds of reasons why. I've heard from female academics that there's a pause in their career, but they're seldom comfortable talking about it. I think that vulnerability is still uncomfortable for us, even though that vulnerability shows a tremendous strength. You were identifying, if you can articulate it to the satisfaction of your mentors, look, I need to do this. Yeah. It doesn't make sense on paper. It doesn't make sense out loud, but this is what I need to do. And somewhere in continuing to gut check along the way, you were able to say, well, I've got to adjunct. I have to keep in the game. Now I have to go back to school. No, I can't have these commutes, so I have to go to this school. Now I'm ready to full-time do my career. You kept gut checking and kept moving your course where you could to meet all of these competing goals.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't, I think that most women that choose to pursue this career, as you've said, at some point have to deal with decisions like that in ways that maybe their husbands don't, or maybe they're not as, as strained by. And I think that ultimately trying to stay true, and it isn't always easy, but trying to stay true to what your goals are. It's especially not easy if they're like competing and they're equally competing with each other. And then you've got the whole maternal guilt thing as well, which I think maybe dads may not have as much of, driving you as well. So as you're building this career and kind of reputation in your field, your kids are weighing on you. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but just their development, their love, their peers, their educate, everything is just constantly weighing on you, constantly sitting on your shoulders in a way that you feel personally, even if you've got a super like helpful partner and a great egalitarian relationship, it still just weighs on your shoulders in ways that I don't think it probably does on his. And that's tough. Right? It's tough. It's tough to make sure that you don't lose sight of what your goals are while you're navigating that. And ultimately though, that guilt is always there. And I will give you one little example, because I don't want to dominate the whole thing, but one little example from my own experience, very recent experience. I got obviously some advanced copies of this book. They came to the house a day or two before the release date. And I saved, both of my boys were so excited about this, right? Oh, mom's an author and she's going to have a book, and just very excited about it and very impressed. And they continue to be impressed. My oldest son, you know, tells me probably once every other day how proud he is of me for being an author. And so there's that huge payoff there with that balancing piece, right? But the day that it was released, when they came down for breakfast, it was July 13th. I laid the book in the middle of the table because I was so excited and I knew they would be too. And my youngest jumped up and down and was like, oh my gosh, mom's an author. He was so excited. And my older son was a little more tempered in his response. He said, that is really cool. He picked the book up and, you know, he could feel it and he was flipping through the pages. And I pointed out kind of the dedication because he was in that, and the acknowledgments and things like that. I pointed it out to both of them. But once they were both over that excitement, my oldest son looked at me square in the eyes and he said, great. So now that the book's out, does this mean you're going to spend more time with us? And as if that wasn't enough, right? And he didn't mean that in a bad way, but as if that wasn't enough of a guilt induction for me, that very morning I had been looking for grants to start a new project. And so I just doubled over with guilt when he said that to me. So I don't know, that might be too much, but it's definitely an ongoing struggle, and one where you've got to be, I think, very dedicated to your career to be able to, at least for me, to be able to withstand it and constantly be looking for ways to balance it and make yourself feel like you're doing the best that you can and you're being a good mom and you're doing a great job developing your career at the same time.
And it sounds like also taking the long road.
Yes.
You know, your goals have all been coming along the path, but by making a longer path to reach all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads to my next question, which is, what inspired this particular book?
A return to my doctoral program. That's what inspired this particular book. And, you know, that early inspiration, I didn't realize that I would eventually turn it into a book. But as I mentioned earlier, my husband and I were child-free for 12 years, and we spent that time, I should say human child-free for 12 years. We spent that time as a married couple, but with our fur baby, with Chew Bear. And Chew Bear was a chow chow, and I had gotten her as an undergraduate in desperate need of some companionship. I had gotten her and brought her into my life before I met my husband, and we became very, very, very close. And she fairly rapidly became like a child to me, even before I met my husband. And then once he and I met and began dating, I think that he saw how wrapped up I was in her, and he became pretty wrapped up in her as well. And as we got married and began interacting with that kind of new relationship, she just melded right on in as not only a member of our family, but as our child. And if you'd asked either one of us at the time, hey, you know, you're treating that dog like a human baby, right? I mean, you rock her and you buy special gifts for her and you travel everywhere with her and you take her into consideration for, you know, the kinds of trips that you'll take and the kinds of places that you're living and so on and so forth. We would have said, well, of course we do, but that doesn't mean we think of her like a child. That wasn't until that realization and the motivation for this work anyway, the initial pieces of the work didn't come until she was 10 years old and diagnosed with lymphoma. And of course, I talk about that in the introduction to the book, kind of as being an impetus for this research. But that experience of being told that we were losing Chewbacca. Initially, we were told we only had 30 days left with her, which was gut-wrenching. And like, you know, I have my human children now, but at the time, it felt like I was losing a human child. I was being told that my child would be gone in 30 days. And the experience of navigating different kinds of specialists and then talking to them always, almost always with her in the room, really just, you know, the realization that the ways in which I was talking about treatments and talking about options in front of her was like I would be behaving in front of a human child. Helped me to begin thinking about why that was, how that could have possibly come to fruition. Was I the only person? I couldn't possibly be the only person behaving like this. I mean, my husband was behaving like this, but we couldn't be the only two people. The relationship with her was much, much different from the relationship that we had in my family of orientation, my family, my childhood family. It was much different. Just, bonding with her like that and having her literally be a part of probably every minute of our lives. And so I think that really she was 50% of the driving motivation, and those questions were part of that motivation. And then the return to grad school and looking through the literature and realizing, especially in sociology, so few people had addressed this in any way whatsoever, was the other 50%. Like, somebody has to do work on this. And I think it's going to be me. And remember earlier, I was talking about probably starting 2 years out from when I actually got back into grad school with my mentor from UCR, trying to navigate my way through, that's a horrible topic. You can't do that topic, not in sociology, human-animal interactions in sociology. You are not going to be able to make this happen. But I was bound and determined to make it happen. And, you know, at TWU, I will say this about my program at TWU, that topic was welcomed with open arms. They were excited about it, interested in it, wanted to, you know, kind of support me in that endeavor. And in many ways, being in a lesser known department, I think, is what made them able to support me in that way. And so with mentors there, as I got started in that program, who understood what my goal was and what my intentions were with that dissertation, I was really able to kind of dig in and start thinking about designs and methodological designs and the ways in which I would move past just kind of sort of an ethnographic approach to my own experiences.
So for listeners who may not have been able to get a copy of the book yet, can you give them the elevator pitch? What's the synopsis if you had to describe this for them?
The elevator pitch for my book would be that our cultural definitions of family have been rapidly changing since the 1970s, and the vast majority of family work in sociology is still about traditional families, that is the nuclear family, and to some degree, non-traditional families. This book is about the non-traditional family piece, the evolution since the 1970s of changes in the family structure and family households that would eventually include what I'm talking about, which is the multi-species family. And I'll just add one more sentence to that. And within the evolution of the multi-species family, the kinds of familial identities typically associated with other humans that have become integrated with our dogs and cats in the United States.
And you give a wonderful example early on in the book about that. You're with, I don't know if she's yet your mother-in-law or she's soon to be your mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And you have Chewbacca, Chew Bear, and your either boyfriend or new husband, and you're having this interaction at the dinner table, all of you. Can you share that story?
Yes, and that story happened over and over again. It's kind of a conglomeration of so many experiences with FAMU. So we were married. We were newly married at the time. And my husband's mother is Finnish. And so in Finnish, they don't just say grandmother, right, or mother. For grandmother, they would say FAMUR. Or FAMU would be kind of the familiar, like grandma FAMU. And so Schubert, being our kind of child as she was, FAMU completely bought into that as a grandmother, right? As a grandmother to her grand dog. And at the dinner table, we would sit when we go over, we always took Schubert with us, and FAMU would have a special little plate prepared for her full of human food, which we didn't often approve of. As Schubert's pet parents, we didn't approve of giving her a lot of greasy kind of gourmet. FAMU is a gourmet prepared foods. But she always had a special little plate and would give Schubert nibbles and niblets off of it throughout the meal. And she would just look at me and speak in Schubert's voice, "Look, mommy, I love, love, love this. I want to have another piece, please, mommy." And I would look at FAMU square in the eyes and tell her, "Absolutely not. She can't have any more. She's going to become ill or spoiled. You're going to spoil her and she will not eat for us properly at home." And so I think that particular story really replicates the relationship that extended beyond my husband and myself. And I talk about that in one of the chapters in the book, to extended family, to FAMU, where, you know, she was perfectly willing to accept us as a child-free family and very happy to take Schubert in as her grand dog. And she would have pictures of her and share pictures with her friends of Schubert. She had pictures up on the refrigerator of Schubert and us when we would go on trips. She traveled with us. When we moved to Los Angeles, she actually traveled with us with the intention of helping us take care of Schubert while we looked for places to live that would be suitable for the three of us. And so I think that that's a really nice example from my own experience, is a really nice example of how this idea of a multi-species family is not just isolated to, the family of procreation or the nuclear family or single parent family, if you will. It very much so is expanding out to extended family networks, and it is introducing, in many cases, the kinds of familial identities that would not be present otherwise if human children were not in the picture.
And as you said a few minutes ago, you were getting the sense this wasn't just unique to you all, that if your family was acting this way, other families were probably acting this way as well. But to write a book and have research to prove it, you had to go out and find more families like yours and do your field study work. And one of the things that's really fascinating in your book is in the appendices, you really lay out exactly how you put together this study and what it entailed. And I wonder if for listeners, you could talk about how you designed the field work of this and walk us through that process a bit, because it's really fascinating.
Oh, well, thank you. Sometimes when you write about the methods section, it's almost you worry that that's going to be the section, like in a journal article or in your book or whatever, that people are going to go, "Oh, the methods section, moving on," right? You worry that nobody's going to read that section. And so I am really appreciative that people and that you read it and thought about it and saw. I did put a lot of work into trying to explain how I did it, how I developed it, and the reasons for why I developed each leg of it. It really wound up being a four-phased project that took place across about 4 years, 4.5 years or so, and kind of traversed across my doctoral years and my dissertation into my career as a junior faculty member. And, but it wasn't planned that way. It was a work in progress. It started out, again, for my dissertation. I was still kind of feeling around in the dark about how I could go about, I guess, elucidating a really a nuanced relationship that could very easily be described by naysayers, if you will, as all in my imagination. Right? This is all perceptual and not something that would be, in sociology, not something that really would be a legitimate sociological topic. And so the initial project that I designed for my dissertation was really driven by the idea of language brokering, where you have children, immigrant children that have moved with their families to a new country and their parents don't speak the native language, but they do by virtue of the fact that they are in school and they're learning the native language, learning English in that new country, for example. They are able to language broker for their parents. Their parents don't have the new language, but their parents have things like bills and so on and so forth, healthcare, things that have to be taken care of. And so those kids step in and they translate and very much so are forced to kind of become adults. But that was kind of the impetus for this initial stage was finding a context that I could go in and thinking of how people represent their animals' needs, their healthcare needs, their wants and desires in terms of kind of interaction and love and toys and so on and so forth, how I could somehow show that happening in a way that sociology would go, oh, well, that is very sociological, right? Because this was another main motivation for me was really trying to get the discipline to understand, right? To see that this is not something that should be excluded from our area. And so ultimately what I decided I would do is find a veterinary clinic locally that would be willing to allow me to engage in some participant observation hours with them, and that I would gather data through observations and memoing and very informal, really informal interviewing with people while they were in the clinics about their relationships with their animals, but also watching those interactions between people and their animals and between people and their vets and the vet techs in terms of kind of language brokering, if you will, translating over all of the different feelings and intentions and needs and emotions that their animals were experiencing for the veterinary staff. And it wound up being perfect because that's exactly what I wanted was to be able to have people just say, you know, my puppy dog is not feeling well today. And I can tell that because she isn't lifting her head up off the ground the way she normally does. She's not as perky as she is when I walk in the room. When I offer food or when I pick up a toy, she has zero interest. And these are just things that I know don't add up. And no, I can't say to you that she's throwing up or that she's drinking too much water or she's limping, but I can tell that there's something going on with her. And inevitably, and this is what I thought was a really nice outcome, was that there was something going on, right? They had translated it properly for the veterinarian. And the veterinarian was able to go in and run blood tests and feel their abdomens or do x-rays or whatever needed to be done in order to figure out what was going on. And almost always they were absolutely right. And I just thought, this is so fantastic. They are... These kind of pet parents are being able to come in and advocate for their dogs and cats in a way that really you would see a parent doing for their infant or their toddler, you know, kids that maybe are too young to verbalize properly that something's wrong, but there's clearly something wrong. And so from there, I started thinking, and it happened pretty quickly, I really started realizing empirical evidence all around me that indeed I was not alone. My husband and I were not alone, that there were tons of families coming through the clinic that I ultimately wound up doing my participant observation in that were behaving as if their animals were more than animals. They were more than pets. They were really more than family members. They were like children. And I think it probably, and I talk about this in the book, it really kind of depended as well on family structure, but that was something that I realized later on, because people that were coming in with their young children, their young human children, were interacting a little bit differently with their dogs and cats, still very much so lovingly towards them, but probably not behaving as a parent would towards a dog, a child. But the kids that I saw interacting with those dogs and cats in that particular context seemed to be doing it as if they were behaving towards a sibling rather than a pet, right? Or rather than just some kind of generalized family member. They were acting as if their dogs and cats were pets. And so from those observations, I started thinking about my own experiences and these different people that I was seeing in the clinic, and decided that I would start recruiting for in-depth interviews. So I went back to my IRB and pitched another project, which my advisor at the time probably thought I was crazy, because I just started a project a couple of months earlier with the intention of making that my dissertation project. But then I went back, I developed another IRB proposal with in-depth interviews, and more focused on thinking about dogs and cats as family members with human familial identities, got that passed, and then started recruiting in the vet clinic, but also recruiting on my campus through the message boards, and doing some snowball recruiting as well from people that were that had already agreed to participate in it. And so I developed that as a second stage, and I wound up doing my dissertation, or finishing out my dissertation, with about, I think, probably 23 interviews. I graduated and realized that I probably really wanted to turn this into a book, but I also knew I didn't have enough to turn it into a book. And so I spent that summer after I graduated collecting some more in-depth interviews, and then began pitching. I'm trying to remember the exact order I did this in. I guess I didn't start pitching it yet. I guess I started realizing, because I was using identity theory, I began realizing I couldn't just talk about this at the micro level. I was going to have to talk about it in terms of how these group level interactions were connecting up to more macro level structures, like kinship and culture and things like that, in order to be able to support the argument in the book. And so I designed a context analysis project. And then I think after I got that designed is when I started pitching the book. So that was my third stage. And the design of that stage was pre-pitching of the book. I started pitching the book and started kind of simultaneously working on context analysis of advertisements that would demonstrate that particular relationship within the family. Got the book contract with fabulous New York University Press and Eileen Kalish, who is she's really an incredible editor, really good in terms of development, also really good at being very blunt, telling you when you've got to change things, patient but blunt, right? Fantastic. It's what I needed. She's great. And so did that, and then realized that I wanted to start a new project, because again, this has just kind of been an evolution, a project of evolution, right? The context analysis and the proposal itself, in my mind, I started thinking about the life course and how these relationships have changed, right? So it's not just about family structures and household structures. It's also about life course and stages of the life, the family life course. And so I realized I'd really been looking at people without human children, whether it was because they were child-free or they were involuntarily childless. And then I've been looking as well at people who had human children. So this would be, you know, in family development theory, it would be the second stage of the adult family life course, or family of procreation. And it just occurred to me, I should start a new project. I should start a new project and interview empty nesters, so I can just kind of see, you know, gather data and have the framework in place to continue gathering data on this kind of life course transition and the ways in which dogs and cats within the family in the United States are evolve along with us in our familial life courses. And so the book, right, the methods section kind of dives, it does a deep dive into how each one of those stages were built and how I came to the idea that I should do another stage. It very much so was not planned out from the beginning. I probably should have said that at the start of this whole thing. But here at the end of my talking about the methods, it was a work in progress. And frankly, I haven't stopped working on it, right? I mean, I'm continuing on Empty Nester interviewing and am starting a new project right now looking at the impacts of the companion animal on family structures and household structures and relationships in the midst of the pandemic. So that
leads to my next question, which is in the methods, you talk about being in the vet clinics and you talk about the difficulty in getting access in the first place, that while sociology was giving you some pushback about, are these really within the bonds of family studies, veterinarians were giving you pushback and saying, well, these are medically protected appointments. We have ethics and rules just like human doctors do, and we can't just let you come in here. We don't even know you. And the clinic managers wouldn't return your calls, and you were getting nowhere. And then when you were talking to your own family vet about wanting to do this, that's when they got on board because of your pre-existing relationships and probably because they trusted how you treated your own pets. They had a sense of how you were going to treat other pet owners. You weren't this stranger calling saying, can I come stare at your clients? And then another really interesting part of your research was, as you mentioned a moment ago, about the advertisements about products aimed at pet parents and really tapping into that culture of people feeling that they are pet parents. So of course they want pet insurance, and of course they want shoes for their pet, and of course they want birthday party hats for their pet, and all of these things that get advertised. Those advertisements didn't require a face-to-face interaction beyond a very interesting experience you had in going to the librarian and saying, why aren't there any ads? I'm looking in the computer and nothing comes up. And she had to shout out to all the reference librarians out there who help us do what we do. She had to give you the keywords for the search. But can you talk about the importance of that face-to-face interactions in those pet clinics that can't be reproduced through sitting in a library or pulling up archival data?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was. So if you are having trouble recruiting or finding a location for recruitment or just a location to do field work, it can be very frustrating. And that was a really frustrating part. I had this great idea. This was really my first real project that I was working on all by myself. And I just kept getting doors shut in my face. And I could have started out with my own personal vet. But at the time, I chose not to. I kind of thought it would be a conflict of interest somehow, that maybe it would be an imposition on his clinic, or he might look ill on me. I don't know. I felt like maybe ethically and methodologically, I should try to find a place that I was not personally connected to. I went through a lot of closed doors and refusals to even let me talk to a clinic manager before I ultimately wound up just kind of informally sharing with my clinic, with my veterinarian, about what I was up to and what I was hoping to do. And so sometimes, like, the answer to those kinds of fieldwork questions is just, it's right in your backyard, and you may have completely just shut it off as an option and not realized how much time you're wasting because you decided for them before you gave them the chance to decide, right, whether or not they would allow you to be, whether or not they would allow that relationship to develop into something that maybe is a little more professional and academic, beyond just, in this case, veterinarian and client. But really, I think that, ultimately the result of that was being able to get into that clinic and just I had access. He gave me access to the whole clinic. The only thing I didn't have access to, for very good reason, was euthanasia appointments. I was allowed to sit out front. I could sit in on appointments. Obviously, in order to stay in the appointments, I had to have an informed consent signed by the client. He and I and the clinic manager kind of worked through very nicely how to get that done in a way that would not disrupt his practice and his flow, while at the same time would allow me to kind of build some rapport with clients. It just really, once I found that he was willing to do this, it flowed along so very nicely, and was an experience being able to speak to people, even if it was just informally, because at that point I was not doing in-depth interviews. It's just kind of informal talk, just asking them questions about, how they got their dogs, or why they adopted three cats at the same time, or just little things like that, that I never would have written into an interview guide, right? Just little things that built so much of the foundation for me about what I would eventually put into those semi-structured interview guides, but B, even what I was looking for in images once I got to the context analysis piece of this, that I wouldn't have gotten had I just started with a semi-structured interview format. I wouldn't have gotten that, because semi-structured interviews are about, certainly you can flex and change and add probes and things like that as you go, but they're still structured. Being able to be in that kind of very informal setting where people were just willing to kind of chat with me, this wasn't inconvenient for them because they were already there. And the clinic oftentimes had long wait times. So being able to talk to somebody sitting in the exam room was convenient and nice for them and helped the time pass, gave me so many nuances and so many ideas that I just wouldn't have gotten sitting, sitting doing Zoom interviews now. Right? I think that there's probably a lot of that's going on now. And those are easy. We don't have to leave our homes. We don't have to set up, beyond the scheduling, we don't have to set up places to meet whom we're interacting with. But I think that we are missing out on so much in terms of body language and nuances with those non-human animals, with dogs and cats in their environment, with their family members, that we can't get across Zoom. We can't get across diving into archives. I think there's a lot of value in that. I think there's lots of value in archival research, especially in the area that I'm researching right now. There's been some pretty good work done in terms of pet products, the historical development of pet products in the U.S. that took deep dives into archives. But if you're trying to kind of move beyond the historical, and my book definitely addresses the historical and demographic patterns and things like that, but if you're trying to move into a very kind of personal realm, a nuanced realm, being there with people, being out in the field and just feeling the vibes, seeing nuances that you can't really, or they can't put words to, and you can't really, it takes you a while to sit and think and analyze about what the nuances are for a woman who, and I know I talk about her in the book, but a woman who comes in and just decides to share with you that she's getting a divorce and she was abused, physically abused by her husband, whom she's divorcing now, and the struggle that they're having over their dog. I just don't know that I wouldn't have known to ask that question. Certainly wouldn't have known to ask it over Zoom. And I don't know that she would have shared that with me over Zoom. It just came out of left field. It was such a emotional, impactful moment for me. And I think for her too. And the way that she parted that visit was just as fast to cut off the communication, right? It was just like something she wanted to spit out right then and there and share with me and then be done with it and go on about her life. And being in that context, I think, is what enabled her to do that. And knowing that she would never see me again. I didn't know her name, right? I mean, I I guess I could have gone back through my informed consents, but that would have been a violation of ethics. So certainly I didn't, right? She just felt very comfortable and felt like she could share that. So I don't know. I've probably talked too much on that, but I think that there's a lot of value with being out in the field, whether you're doing observations or participant observations or even ethnographies, like full-fledged ethnographies that are recent movement because of the pandemic onto more Zoom platforms, virtual platforms, you know, deep dives into archives. Are not going to get for us. And so I think we have to be careful not to abandon those kinds of methods in the midst of what the pandemic is moving us towards in terms of scholarship right now, and especially over the past year and a half for grad students who may be, you know, trying to work on their dissertation in the midst of a very kind of isolating event. So.
In the few minutes we have left, I wanted to ask you about another story that's in the book, and it's just in there in a moment, but it was one that was important to me. You're shopping and you're in the checkout line and you're trying to rush through like every busy person is, and your son is saying, "Mom, I think you should look at this magazine," saying, you know, "Tell me about it in the car." You're trying to stay on schedule and you're already behind schedule. At least that was implied in the story. I could just feel it, like she has to go. And he manages to get your attention and he shows you the magazine. Can you talk about that moment?
That was a fun moment. You know, one thing that I've really enjoyed, and again, you know, we talked about this earlier, walking that tightrope between being a parent and being a professional. One thing I've really enjoyed is watching them develop, my boys develop kind of as researchers in their own right. And that, oh, there's one of my multi-species family members barking right now. Protecting his homestead. That particular moment was embarrassing to me as a researcher in front of my children, but also really heartwarming because he was so persistent and wanted me to look at that magazine. I needed to get out of there. We were headed to piano lessons. And at the time, my husband was traveling constantly. So really, you know, he traveled 4 to 5 days a week. And so typically pre-pandemic, I was a single parent during the week, developing a career, working full time, raising the boys, administering, blah, blah, blah. I was doing it all. And we were in that line. I had to get to piano lessons with them. And he was persistent with me with that magazine. I have a picture of the magazine in the book, right, of the cover of that magazine. But him just saying, "Mom, you really got to look at this," and me blowing him off. And honestly, I don't really say this so much in the book, but a big part of my stopping, about half of it was pet parent when he said that, and the other part of it was, and here we are returning back to earlier in this podcast, mommy guilt. Andrea, just stop for a second. It's important to him. Turn around and take a look at what he's trying to say to you. And he just said, pet parent, take a look. And, you know, I turned around and looked at it and it was just a gold mine. It was not something I had really seen. It was not something I was observing with my sociological eye. I had not been looking at those magazines, but there was my little junior researcher who loves magazines. Both of them love magazines in the checkout line, right? They love looking through those. And there he was with his sociological eye and knowing what I was writing about, pulling up a nice piece of new data and really something that made me start thinking about, as I thought about that context analysis project, started making me think about what I could use in advertising, magazines, print media that would help me support some of my arguments. So it was that was a really interesting, fun moment. I remember it very fondly.
What do you hope this book sparks?
I hope it sparks a minimum of two things. Sociology as a discipline has been very hesitant to accept human-animal interactionist perspectives as sociological. The discipline itself, or the professional association, I should say, so the American Sociological Association, was willing back in, I think, 2001 or 2002. They were eventually convinced to start a section. So a section in ASA, there's lots of different sections, like a sub-discipline within sociology. So ASA was eventually convinced by early human-animal interactionists of the importance for developing an animals and society section. But the section has struggled. It's continued to struggle against mainstream sociology in terms of mainstream sociology just saying, we just don't see the point. This is a discipline about human social structures, human interaction, human outcomes. We don't need animals. That's ethology. That's biology. That's anthropology. It's not sociology. And there have been many of us over the past 20 years that have worked really hard to try and show the mainstream discipline ways in which it absolutely is sociological. And this book, one of the goals that I hope to accomplish with it is this book, using concepts like demographic transition theory is key to family demography. Using second demographic transition is sometimes a controversial theory within family demography, but still very much so a part of their study. And certainly using it to show the sociology of family, why this would be an important non-traditional family to include in their work, to include in thinking about impoverished families and their lack of access to veterinary care and their lack of access to money to spend on food for their pets, and how that means that they now have to give up their, they may have to surrender their animals. And then this creates socio-emotional problems, depression and anxiety for children in those impoverished families, right? Thinking about the multi-species family in that light, thinking about it in the light of racial and ethnic relations. These are important pieces that need to be considered, not just within the sociology of family, but even broader, like thinking about race and ethnicity and critical sociological theory and areas like that. So that would be my first goal, is really getting mainstream sociology to see the point in this. In a work that's very much so like a lot of the other work that they would generate just with dogs and cats as part of it. And then the other goal would be identity theory. So identity theory is a social psychological approach to understanding the ways in which we develop the identities that we have. And one of the premises is that our identities, human identities, are developed in interaction with other humans. And Sheldon Stryker, the early stalwart in identity theory, alongside others, Peter Burke, for example, have been pretty definitive in focusing on human-to-human interaction. But my book, I'm hoping, really goes a long way towards showing the benefit of moving beyond kind of an anthropocentric approach to identity and the ways in which we develop our identities. One of the main intentions of it was trying to show identity theorists how it would be possible for a person to interact with a non-human animal and have the interaction, a two-way interaction, really, because everyone that I spoke with was in full, everyone, 100% of the people that I spoke with were in full agreement that their dogs and cats interact with them and understand an awful lot about what's going on and what's being said to them. And so helping or kind of pushing identity theory in the direction of our identities can be developed in tandem with non-human actors as well is really a main goal for this book on, you know, getting identity theory to kind of open up to at least open up to the idea that shifting over from human to human interaction is very fruitful. Shifting over to human non-human interaction is very fruitful, especially as we move into advancing technological fields like artificial intelligence and other areas that would lend themselves to identity development. And once we can kind of open that up, we begin to be able to explore a lot of other areas that are germane to identity development, but also germane to things like socio-emotional health and prevalence of anxiety and depression, work-family balance, and all of these other fields that go along with kind of understanding the identities and the identity hierarchies and struggles that we have within that hierarchy as we try to prioritize our internalized identities. So that would be the two big goals that I'm aiming for with the book.
I like those goals. I am so glad that you came here today and told us all about the background of writing Just Like Family, How Companion Animals Join the Household. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. You've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. Please join us again.